Welcome to the podcast for Healing Neurology, where we talk about everything that can help heal your neurology, which is really everything from food, lifestyle, and medicine to nature, culture, and politics. There's no topic too big or too small. I'm Jillian Ehrlich, family nurse practitioner certified in Ayurveda and functional medicine. And we have a pretty fun guest today. Marilyn Mays, who goes by Mickey, is a professional educator, researcher, 3D quantitative analysis specialist, radiologic technologist, consultant, and manager with over 15 years of experience in performance and training regarding diagnostic imaging. So we're going to talk about brain imaging today, all the different ways you can look at and inside a person's head. She's been the clinical director at Cortex for the last 6 years, and they have a pretty interesting report called a NeuroQuant, and that's what we'll be talking about. And prior to that, Mickey worked at Stanford as the director of their radiology department in 3D quantitative analysis, manually doing what Cortex, with this NeuroQuant report, does automatically now. So she's written, lectured, and taught curriculum and courses discussing these topics, which actually target neurologic evaluation, including neurologic manifestations of COVID-19, MRI imaging for multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, and other topics, cognitive decline. So that's what we're going to be talking today. So Mickey, welcome. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you, Jillian. That's quite an introduction.
I know you. This is a high bar. We're excited
to be a part of this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. This magic. Okay. So there's a lot going on in a person's head, in our heads and our skulls and our brains. So let's just start kind of most basic to most complex. What are our different options and what do we see inside head imaging?
So our most basic option would be just plain X-ray, and that uses electromagnetic energy beams to penetrate the skull. And so for the most part, X-ray shows bony trabecula and bony detail really nicely. It doesn't show a lot of soft tissue really, really exquisitely. So we can see joint space widening or narrowing. But for the brain, we don't really have joints. So it's really useful looking at sinuses, looking at maybe pituitary and bony detail. So we might start with an X-ray for a dementia patient, really just to rule out any foreign bodies or large tumors, something where the X-ray beam would not attenuate. And then we could see it via X-ray.
And what did, when you say attenuate, what does attenuate mean in regards to an X-ray?
Yeah, just really to pass through. So when the X-ray beam passes through the body, in our instance here, the brain specifically, the beam will be blocked by the density of the structures. So if you've got bone, not very much of the X-ray beam is going to penetrate because it's a very dense structure. Therefore, we'll see a kind of white area on the X-ray. If the beam penetrates thoroughly, like in a sinus cavity, because it's primarily air, then we're going to see a dark area on that X-ray. So that's what I mean by attenuation.
Got it. Okay. So that's X-ray. Mm-hmm. What's next?
Next up would be CT. Now CT is computed tomography, and that's a structural imaging method that also uses X-ray, but we take the X-rays in a sort of tomographic or a slice by slice way, and then reconstruct the images in different planes. So X-ray has the same ability to use the attenuation like explained in the X-ray, but in CT, we can really identify abnormalities at another level because now we can start seeing not only exquisite bony detail, but we can also see other fine detail of soft tissues like evidence of atrophy, hydrocephaly, maybe subdural hematomas. So it's really good for looking at things like that. Also, structural fractures can be really nice with CT. However, the most exquisite soft tissue detail is going to be seen with magnetic resonance imaging or MRI. So MRI uses magnetic fields and radio waves to look at hydrogen atoms. And you can look at any part of the body with that. And it can detect the same kind of things as CT scans, but it's really exquisite for soft tissue. So certain conditions, specifically brain atrophy, brain damage from basically anything, small strokes, subtle ischemia, MRI is really wonderful. So that's the go-to for most brain images. However, usually CT will be done in an emergent situation because MRI has some contraindications. For instance, if the patient has an aneurysm clip or a pacemaker and they don't know it because the patient's unconscious, we would use CT first.
And is CT faster than MRI?
Yes, by a long shot. Another thing about CT is a lot of times they'll use contrast media for brain imaging, particularly when we're looking at arteries and vessels. And I'll talk about that in a minute too. But usually MRI of the brain is done without contrast, particularly if we are not looking for post-surgical or brain tumor situations.
So that's kind of for looking at the brain and the structures of the brain. And we'll talk a little bit more about like why we use that for in different disease conditions. But talk to us about when we look at vessels and vasculature and the circulatory system, because we can look at that through CT or MRI. Right.
So CTA or computed tomography angiogram, that always is going to require contrast media. So there's a little bit of a risk to the patient in using CT in that it also uses radiation, ionizing radiation like X-ray, and you're going to have contrast media or iodine. So people who are allergic to those or think they may have an allergic reaction or have contraindications due to kidney disease may not want to have a CT scan, despite the fact that it's shorter and faster. Mm-hmm. The detail of a CTA or angiogram using CT is actually very good. It's probably the same quality as MRI, but it does have those other kind of factors. So it'll show aneurysms, strokes, and any changes to the arteries. Now, MRI is going to show the same basic thing, maybe with a little better detail. You can see small plaques and little stenosis areas, deep vein thrombosis if you're looking at vascular as far as veins instead of arteries. So with MRI, you can do the magnetic resonance angiogram and a magnetic resonance venogram. So we're going to see that deep vein thrombosis if we're doing the venogram, looking at the venous flow versus looking at arterial flow and looking at arteries. So MRI is great for both of those, and there's no ionizing radiation. However, it costs a little bit more and it takes a little bit longer. And of course, it has those contraindications if there's any metal in the body.
And then when would we use contrast in like gadolinium?
So gadolinium is definitely used for various studies in MRI. Generally speaking, to do an angiogram, an MR angiogram or an MR venogram, you do not need contrast media. We generally will inject contrast if we're looking for post-surgical changes so we can really identify the difference between scar tissue and some sort of new pathology with contrast. And also if we're looking for any sort of cancerous, you know, pathology. So it highlights like a Christmas tree in those instances when you use gadolinium.
Do you know why cancer lights up with gadolinium?
Yeah, because MRI is looking at, it's using magnetism and it's using radio frequency waves. So the radio waves are basically sent in to tip over the hydrogen atoms in the body. Mm-hmm. And as that happens, the magnet will align all those atoms to the frequency of the coil, if that makes sense. And so these are all tipping and we're using all this water. So if there's an area in the body that's cancerous, it's going to have a different rate of perfusion of that water flow through it. So we capitalize on that with the gadolinium and we can see those areas light up as that gadolinium infusion is either being at a faster rate or slower rate, depending on what the disease process is.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah. It's so genius that it's really incredible. And to think it's been around for quite a while now and it just keeps getting better and faster.
Oh yeah.
Very exciting. Yeah.
It's very exciting. And so what other types of scans are out there for a person's head?
So another thing that can be utilized, and particularly I've been working in the dementia space and neurodegenerative disease space for about 6 years now. So I'm kind of focusing on that. But PET scan is another one. So positron emission tomography. Mm-hmm. Now, in contrast to CT and MRI, PET is going to use, it's really more of a chemical or a functional imaging technique, and it's going to use radio tracers. So specifically for types of dementia like Alzheimer's disease, frontotemporal dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, we're going to be looking at a radio tracer called FDG or fluorobeta pair. So in these situations, we're looking for that radio tracer uptake or the speed of the uptake, whether it's slow or whether it's fast, depending on the type of scan and what we're looking at, the type of report. So you can find out a lot about the metabolic processes of the brain and, of course, the entire body using PET scan. So it's just another level of information. But also keep in mind, PET takes a long time and is pretty costly, and it just isn't available as much as CT and MRI.
And so PET scan might be something we would look for with Parkinson's or dopamine usage?
Definitely. Absolutely. You might look for it with Parkinson's. From the neurodegenerative perspective, our fluorobeta pair tracer will generally look at AD, frontotemporal dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, primary progressive aphasia, cortical basal degeneration, things like that. And then the FDG report is going to be binding labels to glucose and the metabolic activity of those subregional tracers. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be addressing AD, frontotemporal dementia, and basically any kind of dementia.
Okay, with PET.
Yes, exactly.
Talk to us a little bit about sinuses, just because so often you're looking at somebody's brain and suddenly you get some information about the sinuses. So what can be seen and what means what on the different tests regarding the sinuses?
Yeah, sinuses are tricky because they're largely filled with air. So in some scans like CT scans, while we can see the bony trabecula to see if maybe there's a deviated septum in the sinus and a nasal cavity, or if there's some other neoplasm going on, we also are going to get artifact from that bone. So if we want to see more soft tissue in the sinuses, which there isn't a lot of because they're basically empty cavities, that will then go to MRI. We'll always start with a sinus series of X-ray to rule out any sort of gross anomalies, and then move on to a CT, and then usually MRI is third. So there's a variety of different things you can see depending on which modality you're using.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the conditions. Can you talk to us about some of the neurologic manifestations of COVID? I know that's something that you've spoken on before.
And yeah,
your listeners are super curious.
Yeah, I did a webinar a while ago on that. So it's very interesting. Now, we were originally looking at a lot of neurodegenerative sort of processes with COVID in the way of smell, taste, and we keep seeing that it continues in what we call the COVID long haulers. But we were also seeing aphasia and things that were somewhat like a dementia process, where there'd be brain confusion, lethargy, things that we would also associate with dementia. So we did see those in COVID patients. And then with COVID long haulers, we continue to see some of those things.
And so we see those as symptoms. Are there particular imaging characteristics that align with those symptoms?
Yeah, that's been a very tricky one. So we are looking at brain structures around the sinuses and looking at frontal lobes and temporal lobes when we're associating those symptoms with COVID. But it has not been a real easy thing. So we've been tweaking that. And at the company that I work for, we did initially create a COVID report to target that. And then we've worked with clinicians around the country to try to hone in as those have changed. And then, you know, we're kind of adapting the reports as needed as we get more information. Unfortunately, there's not been a whole lot of information, as you probably know.
Yeah.
So we continue looking at that. And there are a lot of COVID long haulers, you know, that continue to have issues. We've seen people go full on into comas from COVID. These are normally people that have comorbidities and other pathologies going on. Mm-hmm. So it's really diverse, and we don't know much, actually. It's sad, but we don't know that much yet.
Here's another question that I'm sure many people in the audience are asking themselves regarding brain imaging and as regards brain fog. You know, people have that brain fog is a symptom of long COVID, but also of so many other conditions, chronic fatigue, even IBS. And so I'm just curious if you have any, I know that people would want to ask, does brain fog ever correlate to something clinically in imaging?
So it does in a way. When we're looking at clinical imaging, and I'm talking from a somewhat neurodegenerative perspective. So we start looking at the amygdala, we look at middle frontal lobes, because again, that's associated with reasoning and emotion. We also look at the frontal poles, we look at the thalami, and we look at the whole brain. Mm-hmm. Also, the medial orbitofrontal region, because again, those are associated with smell. So I would say those are the areas. We're also looking for white matter hypointensities, so kind of lesions in the brain as a person, you know, has COVID. So that's kind of the thing we're looking at. Another thing that we're doing is we're looking at a global overview of the brain from a perspective of, in addition to those structures I just mentioned, we're also looking at global volumes as far as the entire lobes and then specific areas of the lobes. And we're looking for both edema and atrophy, trying to identify those patterns. And that's what the company that I work for, Cortex Labs, really does, is we look for patterns of atrophy and expansion and then associate those with specific disease states. So that's kind of what we've done with our product to target COVID.
Tell us some of these different disease states and some of the patterns of like expansion or swelling or contraction and atrophy that you've seen in brain tissue.
Our NeuroQuant first was designed to look at dementia. So from a dementia perspective, our flagship report was an age-related atrophy report, or and just what we call dementia report now. We've kind of rebranded it. And so that one, we're taking a deep dive into looking at the hippocampi and then looking at the inferior lateral ventricles and the association as most people with forms of dementia will see a atrophy of the hippocampi. And then as the structure atrophies, the cerebrospinal fluid fills up the inferior lateral ventricle. So we have a basically response to that. So we're looking at enlarged ventricles, superior lateral, inferior lateral ventricles for kind of ex vacuo expansion associated with that atrophy. So we're using that to measure and then look at the patient's native brain space and then comparing that to a normal population of healthy people and seeing how that person's brain compares to the normal population.
And so the two structures that you're talking about, the hippocampus is a structure that is, it's a tissue, a cluster of neurons and tissue that essentially holds a lot of our memory. And that tissue, as we have neurodegenerative disease, can actually shrink up. Is that right? And it has two sides and they can shrink up differently. Like the right side might be smaller than the left or vice versa. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So in that situation, sometimes we're looking for asymmetry indexes. So another thing we do is we provide a report with any other report that's ordered that's called a general morphometry. Now that report is going to look at those asymmetries. So that becomes really important as we're looking at individual left side and individual right side of the brain structures. The asymmetry index between them can be profound. Now that we see many of our biotoxin physicians use these reports to look at those asymmetry indexes, as those are very important in that association.
Interesting. And are there clinical characteristics that correlate with like a small right-sided hippocampus or a small left-sided hippocampus?
Yes, that's a great question. So seizures are the thing that we're normally going to associate with that sort of asymmetry. So we have a seizure report. It's really targeting temporal lobe epilepsy, any type of hippocampal sclerosis, and unilateral degenerative conditions.
So is it the asymmetry that's the problem, or is it the gestalt size of the right or the left? Does that make sense? Like, is it the relationship between the two halves that's the problem, or
That's a great question. It's both, actually. So in unilateral degenerative conditions, sometimes we'll see one of the hippocampus is really small and the other one looks pretty normal. Mm-hmm. So it's really common in cases of TLE or hippocampal sclerosis to have one side that's sclerotic or atrophied and the other side that's somewhat normal. So we provide a report that looks at that asymmetry index. So in this case, we're really just looking at the right side and then the left side, and then we're taking an asymmetry index of the two. Okay. So just a little bit of math that makes that happen. And that asymmetry is profoundly important because many times we'll see that both sides are within a normal range. Remember, I talked a few minutes ago about the normative database. So we're always comparing these individual structures and individual right and left sides to that normative database. So they both structures may fall within a normal range, but when you look at the asymmetry index and it's outside of a normal 5th to 95th range, then we start knowing, okay, this is probably indicative of some sort of unilateral degenerative process.
And so we started off talking about the hippocampus and the ventricles. Ventricles are interesting because we talk about them as a structure, but similar to the sinuses, they're actually a space, correct?
Correct.
And so you don't want a bigger ventricle because that means that your brain tissue surrounding this space is actually smaller. So if your hippocampus is smaller than normal and if your ventricles are bigger than normal, that's when we have problems, correct?
That's exactly right. That's when we start being really curious that the patient has some sort of neurodegenerative process because as you just said, as the brain atrophies, then we see that exvacuo expansion of the ventricles. And we can see it globally if we have superior lateral ventricle expansion as the brain tissue atrophies, and then specifically in inferior lateral ventricles and third ventricle as those ventricles expand as a response to the atrophy in the hippocampi. And maybe interrenal cortex, smaller structures.
My background started out in Ayurveda, the traditional medical system of India.
Nice.
And I was taught that the seat of our consciousness is in our ventricle, specifically in our third ventricle.
So that's fascinating. I love that.
And there is some fluid, correct, that flows through these ventricles.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. The cerebrospinal fluid.
And so is there any imaging that essentially captures that cerebrospinal fluid flow?
Not necessarily the flow. That's actually kind of a hard one. I mean, indirectly you can, but MRI is really good at looking at cerebrospinal fluid just as part of its general scan. Also, CT is good at looking at fluid of the brain, and it's commonly used for hydrocephaly and things where they're looking at, you know, fluid in the brain. I still think MRI is the go-to here. Just a regular MRI scan can show a huge amount of soft tissue, including fluid.
Can we walk through some of the most common findings on for kind of an aging brain and talk a little bit about like any clinical correlation? So for instance, if you find calcifications, if you're finding ischemia, you know, small vessel ischemic disease, can you talk about some of those elements, please?
Sure. So in just general Alzheimer's disease, we're going to see a sort of gradual pathologic progression in most instances. Mm-hmm. And from the brain's perspective, specifically on MRI, we're going to see global atrophy, especially in the medial temporal lobe, which will include the hippocampi and parahippocampal gyrus and interrenal cortex. Mm-hmm. But with that, pathologically, we're also going to see amyloid plaques. And that's where PET scan can be useful in looking and associating the metabolic perfusion, if you will, these amyloid plaques and the radio tracer that we've used. So you can look at synapse loss and really just global neurodegeneration using MRI and PET. So that's kind of Alzheimer's. And then vascular dementia, you might see really small previous strokes, TIAs, and these are going to have more of an acute onset. And we're going to demonstrate more of a focal or multifocal atrophy of the cortical and or subcortical areas with a dilation of the ventricles. And usually that's going to be large vessel infarcts. We'll see it thalami, basal ganglia, and maybe even thrombosis plaques and atherosclerosis, kind of hardening in those vessels. That would be in a vascular dementia situation.
Can you talk to us a little bit about multiple sclerosis?
Absolutely. That's something that's near and dear to my heart. I have a sister who has MS, and she's been living with a primary progressive for quite a while now. She's doing pretty well, but I'll tell you, that's a rough disease. So multiple sclerosis is a neurodegenerative process where the white matter of the brain or the myelin sheath that covers the neurons is kind of eaten away. In layman's terms, they're eaten away. So as that happens, the part of the body that's controlled by that particular white matter strand, that area will then be diseased or showing some sort of issue. A lot of times in MS, we see the bladder kinesiology as far as legs. It can really attack almost anything. We see vision problems, a variety of things. And it's, you know, a devastating process. And in some cases, it can lead to death. I mean, I know a lot of people think, oh, MS is not fatal, but it certainly can be. So in our company, we have made a tool that is similar to the NeuroQuant tool. We call it NeuroQuant MS. And that is used to look at MS lesions. So as these exacerbations of MS attacks happen, the brain will get lesions. So we can see those lesions using MR most exquisitely. We use something called a flare, and then that flare sequence will really show the lesions. So we create reports following something called the McDonald criteria, which is really just a criteria recommending the dissemination of those lesions in time and space and how they present. So we have made reports following that. And we can track these lesions over time, looking at new, enlarging, shrinking lesions and stable lesions to identify whether or not the treatment, treatments are working.
Actually, I have one other imaging question, general question. Can you talk about what a flare sequence is and the difference between kind of T1, T2?
Sure.
An MR?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm going to go back a little bit. I'm going to talk about NeuroQuant just a hair more. I believe in these products. They're really life-changing. But the basic sequence used for just looking at general anatomy is a T1 weighted image. So our software for NeuroQuant uses just that basic anatomic sequence that's a T1 weighted image. Now, that's run on almost every patient for any MR scan. It's usually the first scan they do. It's not sexy. It doesn't show anything fabulous, really just looking at anatomy. Now, when we start doing other sequences like T2 or like a flare, then we can start seeing pathology. So in the case of our flare sequence, it's a fluid attenuated sequence. So we're looking at the inversion recovery of the fluid. Remember I talked about sending in those radio frequencies and knocking over those hydrogen atoms and then looking at the recovery? That's kind of what we're doing with this fluid attenuated sequence. But in this case, we can see lesions in the brain really, really exquisitely. So we use that sequence in conjunction with that plain anatomical sequence to create this information.
And the T1 or T2 weighted, that is in the machine that's being used, or that's in the report, that's how things are weighed, the data is weighed in the report?
So that is the way that the MRI scan is set up. So when you're doing an MR scan, we have all these protocols. So if you're looking for seizure, you're going to do a specific protocol, where if you're looking for dementia, you're going to do a slightly different protocol. So the sequences that we run, there are multiple sequences within each protocol associated with the pathologic process they're targeting. So generally, for a brain neurodegenerative brain process like MS, we would be doing a T1 weighted scan. And it's a whole set of physics where in T1, fluid is going to be dark, in T2, fluid is going to be bright. So it allows us to look at the body tissues in different ways.
So let's go back to, I think what people can easily picture is something like an x-ray. You know, they used to, at Buster Brown in the 60s, you know, they would x-ray your feet when you went in to try your shoes on, right?
So, right, I remember.
So you stand there and it takes a picture and zip, zap, zoop, you know, you see your bones lit up. Boom, there they are.
Right.
But what's interesting is that when we're looking at something like a foot or a hand, I mean, you can even do this, but they're a little bit more 2D than, say, ball-shaped structure like our head, right? So,
correct.
So when you're looking at a hand, you're going to see, it's going to, the image is going to look very different. What you see when you describe hand, if your hand is flat and you're looking straight down versus if you're right on the plane, like a tiny ant staring at your third finger, then the picture that you see is going to be very different. And the reason I'm kind of harping on this is because I think it's really important that folks understand that the perspective that you take determines a lot of what you see.
That is correct. So in an x-ray, you're right, we're going to see a 2D image. And it's very useful in looking, especially for ortho studies, where you're looking at joint space narrowing or widening, like in the knees. You can see if a knee is bone on bone, and that's going to indicate that the meniscus is basically, you know, gone. So we can see a lot that way. But when we do MRI, specifically when we're doing it for NeuroQuant and other studies for neurodegeneration, we use something called 3D imaging. So you've hit on something really important here. So in a volumetric scan, we're doing one of those scans within the MR protocol that we're going to call volumetric and or 3D. And what that allows us to do is to reformat all of the data that we've got into a 3D model. So now we can basically look at the brain structures and then remodel them into a 3D anatomic visual. So we can look at it from all different planes. And this is one of the differences between CT and MRI. CT is only acquired in an axial plane. So if it's reformatted into another plane, you're going to get some blurring and some degradation of the images. With MR, because you can acquire it in any plane, because it doesn't use x-ray the way CT does, you can acquire it in the plane that's going to best depict and image that specific body part that you're looking at. So if you're looking specifically at the sinuses with MRI, we could run a coronal scan, slicing the brain from ear to ear, or we could do an axial slice specifically through those sinuses, like the sinuses were a loaf of bread. So we can look at them in various orthogonal planes and really see the detail of the pathology and anatomy really well.
That's great. And that analogy of the loaf of bread is fantastic, because you can imagine that your loaf of bread can be oriented ear to ear, from top to bottom of your head, from eyes to the back of your head. You know, the different protocols and the different slices are still, you can reconstruct them, but that you still need to be going after, you still need to be targeting what you suspect is there. You need to have a sense of what you're looking for in order to pick how to look for it.
That's exactly right. So if we're looking at the inner ear canal, we're probably going to want to do that in an axial plane so that we can see, you know, all the inner anatomy of the ears. And then we're probably going to want to do it in a coronal plane also, and even in an oblique plane, which again, with MR, we have that possibility. We don't have that very much with x-ray and CT. It's a much different modality and process.
And I think as a, you know, in my practice, that's one of the things that's complicated, because I can have a patient call me who I haven't seen in 6 months and say, they'll say, can you order me a shoulder MRI? My shoulder hurts. And I think to myself, well, I don't know. I have to know what I'm looking for in order to essentially order what's going to find whatever's wrong.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Mickey. This has been an awesome investigation, deep dive into our different imaging options. And thank you all for listening today with Mickey Mays from Cortex. That is a test that we do in our office that we can order, when we order your MRIs. We've got lots of ways to continue this conversation through Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Please be sure to share this show with your friends. We welcome your rating and review wherever you get your podcasts, and feel free to send topic requests to podcast@centerforhealingneurology.com. We love that you've joined us today to discuss how to make our whole world medicine. We rise or fall together, and we're committed to doing what we can to make as many of us as healthy as possible. And this takes all of us, including you. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Media. Party Fish Media acknowledges that it operates and records on Indigenous Duwamish and Puget Sound Coast Salish land that is still home to the Duwamish tribe. This land is stolen in violation of the Point Elliott Treaty of 1855. We are committed to uplifting the name of these lands and community members from these nations who reside alongside us. For more information on this land, its people, or ways you can help, visit duwamishtribe.org or realrentduwamish.org.